of women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. More at granditasca.org.
Good morning. After 41 days, the U.S. Senate passed a bill to end the shutdown. Part of the deal is another Senate vote on health insurance. What is the House prepared to do? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we hear the voices of National Guard troops put in the middle of the national fight over the president's deployments. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. They say they've grown reluctant to tell people they're in the military. Also, the director of a new movie about the Nuremberg trials on the world choosing justice over vengeance and prosecuting Nazi war crimes. It's Tuesday, November 11th, Veterans Day. It was on this day in 1918 that fighting stopped in World War I. It was called Armistice Day until 1954. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has passed spending legislation that would fund the government until January 30th. The measure now goes to the House, but it's not clear when the government shutdown might end. Meanwhile, a federal judge is accusing the Trump administration of playing vindictive games when it comes to SNAP food benefits. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports a court hearing yesterday examined whether states must essentially take back payments they made to SNAP recipients over the weekend.
After a court order to issue full SNAP payments late last week, some states rushed to get the benefits to people. But when the Supreme Court then paused the order, the Agriculture Department said states must immediately undo those payments and threatened penalties. New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Plaquin says this makes no sense, especially given new moves to possibly end the shutdown.
This administration is still going to the Supreme Court to fight for the right to starve Americans.
A Trump administration attorney says states jumped the gun and should only send partial payments for now. Once the shutdown does end, we'll issue full benefits in 24 hours, he told the judge. Jennifer Lutton, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Aviation Administration is still moving to slow air travel in the U.S. because of the shutdown. Air traffic controllers are supposed to report to work, even though they have not been paid in weeks. Michael McCormick is with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. He previously ran the FAA's air traffic control system for New York.
After this shutdown is over, there is a lot of work to be done in order to hire and replace the air traffic controllers to a level where they need to be. And that will continue to be a problem and be a long-term problem that will cause a lot of heartache and a lot of delays.
President Trump criticized air traffic controllers yesterday who have taken time off and told them to go back to work. He said he would offer bonuses to those who stayed on the job. The Food and Drug Administration is removing stringent warnings about risks from hormone therapy products. These are used to ease symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports on the change in the agency's stance.
Black box warnings on hormone therapies are the FDA's strongest. They're used to inform doctors and patients that a drug can cause serious or life-threatening side effects. The warnings had been on hormone therapies for more than 20 years and say the drugs increase the risk of certain cancers, strokes, and heart attacks. Now the FDA is removing the warnings, saying those risks were overstated. It's a change many doctors have urged the FDA to make, but they say the agency didn't follow its usual procedure for doing so. The FDA convened a special expert panel in July instead of using an existing advisory committee, which follows a stricter process for reviewing evidence and making recommendations. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
This is NPR. Many governments around the world give people cash in an effort to reduce poverty. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, a new study published in The Lancet finds those programs can substantially improve maternal and child health.
In recent years, there's been loads of research showing cash transfers can have significant benefits for households, but there's been less research looking at countrywide effects. To get a broader view, a team of researchers analyzed different health outcomes across 37 low- and middle-income countries with government-sponsored cash aid programs. The benefits were big. Cash transfers helped about 10% more pregnant women get better care, which in turn improved child mortality. Slightly older kids were more likely to get vaccinated, be fed nutritious food, and about 40% less likely to get diarrheal diseases in places with cash transfers. Programs that benefited bigger chunks of the population were associated with greater health improvements. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Frost and freeze warnings are up in the southern U.S. this morning. The National Weather Service has issued winter weather advisories for some southern states. There's a winter storm warning now posted for parts of West Virginia. A tropical storm is approaching Taiwan. Taiwanese officials have evacuated thousands of people away from the island's southern coast. The tropical storm was previously Super Typhoon Feng Wang, and it has already crashed through the Philippines. That's where it killed at least 18 people. The Philippines has had to face two strong typhoons in just a few days. Last week, a typhoon in the Philippines killed around 200 people. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
KEXC went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXC matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Otteson.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education, of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Congress is one step closer to ending the longest government shutdown in American history. The Senate approved a funding bill by a 60-40 vote.
Speaker Mike Johnson called the House of Representatives back to Washington after more than a month off. The House would have to pass the measure and President Trump would need to sign it. The federal government could open within days, although a debate over health insurance subsidies remains unresolved.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass is here. Sam, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
Okay, so what exactly did the Senate pass?
So some of this is very similar to what the Senate has been voting on for weeks now, a temporary funding measure to fund the government for just a few weeks, in this case, through January 30th. But this time, lawmakers also included three bipartisan annual appropriations bills that cover specific agencies like the Department of Agriculture and the FDA. So instead of a short-term extension, those areas will be funded now through next September.
Okay, this is useful to know. This means the government could shut down again at the end of January, but not the whole federal government.
Yeah, it would be just a partial government shutdown. And SNAP benefits, for example, they would not be in danger of running out this time. The package also includes a measure to undo the firings of federal workers during the shutdown and ensures federal workers get back pay. Here's Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine.
This is a great victory for the American people, and it shows that the Senate can work, that we can produce the results that are needed.
Now, I should note a key element that you will not find in the text of this measure, and that's an extension of expiring health care subsidies, which has been the crux of Democrats' shutdown fight. What Senate Republicans have promised is a vote on that in the future.
Oh, Republicans did promise the Democrats a vote, but they could have given them that vote a month ago. They were promising that vote a month ago. It doesn't sound like Democrats got anything near what they wanted.
Yeah, Democrats really wanted something a lot more concrete. So in the end, all but seven Democrats in and one independent who caucuses with them, they voted against this deal. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says he'll hold a vote by mid-December on separate legislation to address the subsidies. But what exactly Democrats put forward is an open question. They need something that can win enough Republican votes. And while some Republicans do talk about wanting to prevent premiums from skyrocketing, they also want reforms. And a few weeks is not a lot of time for an overhaul.
Well, even if a health care bill were to pass the Senate in that vote in December, what are the odds it gets a vote in the House and gets signed by the president?
You know, this is exactly what many Democrats like Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin are worried about.
A handshake deal with my Republican colleagues to reopen the government and no guarantee to actually lower costs is simply not good enough. The people I work for need more than that.
House Speaker Mike Johnson told reporters yesterday he could not guarantee a vote, and it's also unclear what Trump is willing to support.
Okay, so we don't know what's going to happen with people who rely on Obamacare subsidies, Affordable Care Act subsidies, the extra subsidies, we should add. But people who rely on food assistance, who are traveling for Thanksgiving, who are thinking about the FAA and air traffic controllers, do they have relief?
House members have been told to report to Washington for a vote Wednesday. After being out for weeks, Johnson may have his work cut out for him to get this shutdown ending deal to the president, but he says it will get done. The dispute over health care, though, does remain unresolved, along with this contentious political debate about how the shutdown played out, with the midterm elections just around the corner.
NPR's Sam Greenglass, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
The lack of a concrete deal on health care has many Democrats fuming. Illinois Congressman Mike Quigley is among them. He sits on the House Appropriations Committee, and he joins me now. Good morning, Congressman.
Morning.
I want to start with why you're so angry at your colleagues in the Senate for voting for this deal.
Sure. 22 million Americans' health insurance premiums are going to be increasing, 114% on the average, from about $888 to about $1,906. The Senate deal completely abandons them. During this Trump administration, my constituents ask me, what are you doing? I tell them, all I have is my voice and my vote. Mm. This is giving up my vote if I were to vote yes on this. I think if my office would be surrounded by crowds with torches if I voted yes on this. This is absolutely critical in terms of affordability and what's most important to the American people.
But then what is the answer? I mean, the Republicans have refused to budge. Do you just keep the government shut down forever?
No, I think what we saw last Tuesday is some cracks in what the Republicans are doing. They were seeing that they weren't winning this if anybody wins in a shutdown. I think even the president recognized that. And fundamentally, you've got to ask yourself, at what point do you draw the line? This is a president who has reneged on past deals that we've passed into law, spending deals. This is a president who's unilaterally pushed back on the power of the purse of the House and the Senate. So why would you trust them in the first place? Fool me once is probably the lesson of the day.
Now, I understand you're trying to get back to D.C. from Chicago for the vote. When do you expect to vote in the House? And are you and your colleagues going to be able to get back in town with everything going on at the airports?
Yeah, I suspect that they'll probably figure this out and get these flights there. But I think most members would be smart to book multiple flights coming back today. We're hearing that the earliest the vote would be is around 4 o'clock Eastern time Wednesday. So we're trying to head back tonight. One way or another, we'll get there. It does remind me of COVID when we were going back to vote for emergency supplementals and there were no flights and people drove to D.C.
Now, I know you say you're going to vote against this bill. Another Senator Dick Durbin from your home state of Illinois is one of the 8 senators who broke with the party and did vote for this bill. His explanation of why was that although he blames the president and Republicans for the shutdown, he, quote, cannot accept a strategy which wages political battle at the expense of my neighbor's paycheck or the food for his children, unquote. Now, Congressman, this bill does not extend health care subsidies, but it does fund SNAP food benefits through September of 2026. Nearly 2 million people in Illinois receive those benefits. Is this something your constituents needed or need?
Absolutely. And I've been at the Chicago Food Depository programs where we were dispensing the food, people waiting 4 hours for a single box. But we sound like characters from a Dickens novel. You know, can I have more, please? This is fundamental of what they should have had already. And to say, just to give you what the status quo is, you're going to have to sacrifice health care for millions of Americans. It's just not a deal you need to make, especially at a time when the Republicans seem to be cracking.
Given the vote and Democratic senators breaking with the leadership, do you have faith in the leadership of your party in this moment, specifically Senator Chuck Schumer?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll leave the senators to deal with their leadership. You know, my leader, Mr. Jeffries, has said that they're going to stand firm.
Is he whipping the vote against the bill?
Yeah, I he is. And I believe that the Democrats will stand pat. I think last time we only had one or two break from the party. I suspect that'll be the case tomorrow. I don't know what's happening on the Republican caucus. There's always a few who hold out until they get a call from the president, get a photo op, and then they go back to the constituents and declare victory.
Do Republicans need you to pass the bill? We just have a few seconds.
I think they'll get this bill passed, unfortunately, and we go through the status quo. And unfortunately, while people be getting fed, they won't have health care.
That's Democratic Representative Mike Quigley of Illinois. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Here is one thing that President Trump has said in recent months about the revenue being brought in by tariffs. That's money paid by American businesses who pass on some of the costs to consumers. The president is suggesting that some of that money should go back to Americans. As NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, Americans should not count on seeing the check just yet.
Trump is calling the payments dividends, but they are by no means a fleshed-out proposal. He briefly discussed them with reporters on Monday.
One of the things we're going to do, we're going to issue a dividend to our middle-income people and lower-income people of about $2,000, and we're going to use the remaining tariffs to lower our debt.
That's most of the details he has provided on the idea. While details are scant, budget experts are already saying that there just isn't enough money for this idea. Erica York is one of them. She's vice president of federal tax policy at the Right Leaning Tax Foundation.
Even with the most conservative estimates applied to it, it doesn't work.
By her math, if the rebates went to people making under $100,000 per year, that would cost way more than the amount of revenue tariffs will bring in.
You'll see at least a $100 billion gap there between what we could expect the tariffs to generate for the U.S. government versus what the president is promising to spend on tariff rebates for American citizens.
In other words, the proposal could add to the debt. Then again, the White House is already saying the plan might not involve a straightforward check sent to taxpayers. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said on ABC's This Week on Sunday that voters might receive the money in the form of tax cuts that Congress already passed.
It could be just the tax decreases that we are seeing on the president's agenda. You know, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security.
NPR asked for additional details on the plan, but the White House did not answer directly. Talking about revenues puts the Trump administration in a tricky position right now. Just last week, administration lawyers argued before the Supreme Court that revenues aren't the point of the tariffs. Solicitor General John Sauer said this to the justices.
These are regulatory tariffs. They are not revenue-raising tariffs. The fact that they raise revenue is only incidental.
Asked to square that argument with Trump's revenue talk, Bessent said the tariffs are ultimately meant to bring businesses back into the U.S. No matter what, Congress would have to authorize any payments. And even if the government were open, it's not a given that would happen. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:19. Good morning. Thank you for listening to KAXC and Morning Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones member SIPC. We also thank Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. Weather for today, partly to mostly sunny, highs 41 to 46, blustery northwest wind. Lows tonight near 29, and for tomorrow, sunny with highs in the low 40s and breezy northwest wind. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s. The Cass County chapter of the Isaac Walton League will host a spaghetti dinner fundraiser at Union Church in Hackensack this Thursday at 5 o'clock. A presentation on nitrates will follow the dinner. And the Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of holiday decorations. Ahead of their sale happening December 5th, donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4. The KAXE News Team has put together a list of food-related resources across northern Minnesota. You'll find hours and locations of food shelves along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Go to kaxc.org, and if you have anything to add, email news@kaxc.org.
For NPR, comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Nearly 8 decades ago, the Nuremberg trials held by the Allied powers revealed the full horror of the atrocities committed by the Nazi regime during World War II. The new film, Nuremberg, focuses on the Nazis' second-in-command, Hermann Göring, played by Russell Crowe, and the psychiatrist tasked with monitoring him, Douglas Kelly, played by Rami Malek.
Göring is, above all things, a narcissist. The only thing he cares about is building Germany up and then becoming her leader. He does not care about the Jews.
So he's fine with them dying.
And he's fine with them not. The only thing Hermann Göring cares about is Hermann Göring. Does that sound like a man who dedicates himself to the extermination of an entire race?
Much of the tension revolves around how Göring and Kelly try to outsmart each other, leading to a showdown in court. Nuremberg is directed by James Vanderbilt.
Kelly has the highest ranking living Nazi basically dropped into his lap and sort of goes, this is an opportunity to dissect the nature of evil. He goes, you know, what made these men able to commit the crimes that they did? What sets them apart from us? Mm-hmm. Göring, on the other hand, is, you know, looking for his last moment on the world stage. He's looking to define himself. And I think they both ultimately end up having an enormous effect on each other's lives in ways that neither of them anticipated. And that sort of duality was something that I just immediately went, I've never seen that. For me as a filmmaker, you know, you look at the duality between those two men and you go, there's something really rich and dramatic there.
I think what struck me too is Kelly comes to this conclusion that there's not very much that sets Göring apart from the rest of humanity. There isn't a special kind of evil. And I thought about that a lot. I mean, I've worked in lots of different conflicts and watched human beings do absolutely awful things to other human beings.
Göring, you know, was by all accounts an incredibly charming and funny individual. You know, somebody once described him as the best dinner party guest you'd ever have over to your house, which is not what you think of when you think of the Nazis. And I was just so sort of taken by the idea of exploring that. And, you know, the fact that he loves his wife the same way that we love our spouses, that he loves his children the same way we love our children, to me, that, you know, doesn't excuse anything. It actually makes it all the more horrifying.
The moment that this is coming out into the world with concerns around the rise of authoritarianism. And I wanted to just play one clip. It's an interaction between Goering and Kelly from the film.
Let's talk about Hitler. It is interesting you have not asked me this directly before. I'm curious what the attraction was. He was a failed painter, not a very good soldier, yet he's worshipped and revered. He made us feel German again.
He made us feel German again. If you could just describe this moment in this film and what you think it says to an audience today in 2025.
I mean, it's interesting because I wrote that scene 12 years ago,
yeah.
You know, and so it was relevant then, and I certainly feel it's relevant now, and I think, unfortunately, it will be relevant in the future. You know, Goering was someone who, from his perspective, you know, the Treaty of Versailles was a terrible thing, and they needed to build themselves back up, and they needed to feel pride in their country again, and that's one of the things that he, as well as Hitler, sort of exploited in terms of their rise to power. Nuremberg was a pretty remarkable moment in history where, you know, the world came together to choose justice over vengeance and do something that I think was truly a good act.
There was a moment during the trial where you show real footage that was shot in the concentration camps,
yes.
Emaciated survivors, bodies piled up. I had to almost look away, but I forced myself to watch where the bulldozers are just bulldozing like dozens of bodies on top of each other as if they're rubble. Tell me about that choice.
It was something from the very beginning I knew I wanted to do. And as we were casting and I started being able to hire these incredible actors, I said to each of them, you know, listen, I know that you love doing research and I love that about you, but do me a favor and don't watch the footage. Because on the day that we shoot this, I want it to be fresh to you. And we were in our courtroom set, which was built to exact specifications of the real Nuremberg courtroom down to the inch. And we brought out the projector and we had a moment of silence. And I had set up four cameras, one on each of our lead actors. And then we showed the film. And what you see in our movie is the reaction of those actors. Those images are, I think, as powerful today as they were 80 years ago. And I wanted to put you as an audience member in the same shoes as the people were in the courtroom that day when this footage was first shown to the world. You know, one of the reasons the trial were put on by Robert Jackson, Michael Shannon's character, was because he felt that this needed to be recorded, that if we just shoot these men and possibly make them martyrs, people generations later won't believe what happened.
The case law established in the Nuremberg trials is still used today.
Yes.
Paved the way for the creation of an international criminal court. I want to play a moment from the film, the Chief U.S. Prosecutor, Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson, played by Michael Shannon, explaining his vision.
It would have to be a completely international effort. All of the allies would have to participate. The U.S., Britain, France, Russia. You can't do it without the Russians. Four international judges.
You're talking about a tribunal.
Exactly. The world needs to know what these men did.
It's a logistical nightmare.
I know. But it has to be done.
What is the historical significance of the trials today?
I mean, I think it's enormous. It was the first international tribunal. It was sort of, you know, someone described it as sort of building the airplane while you flew it. The historical significance, hopefully, is that we remember there was a moment where something like this could happen and people chose to do the right thing, even though it wasn't the easy thing. Both of my grandfathers fought in World War II. So I grew up with stories about this period of time. I had friends who lost family members in the camps. You can read the books and you can watch the documentaries and you can hear the facts and figures, but a movie makes you feel things.
That's director James Vanderbilt. His new film is Nuremberg. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a note, Sony Pictures Classics is a financial supporter of NPR. We cover it like we cover anything else. This is NPR News.
Justinian Wong's new novel is about how the survival of a patriarchy rests on the shoulders of women. Wong says he drew inspiration from the women in his own life.
As I wrote this book, I fell back in love with my mom because I was like, she's brilliant.
I'm Elsa Chang. More on the new book, Lucky Seed, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
¶¶
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon. It's at 4 o'clock here on KAXE, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. On this Veterans Day, lots of events going on throughout our communities in honor of Veterans Day today, including the closing of post offices and banks.
Post offices, banks, yep.
Yep. That's John Latimer. I'm Heidi Holton. Today at 11 a.m., the VFW Post 1720 in Grand Rapids invites the community to honor veterans with a lunch and a program that will happen at noon. And also going on, Crow Wing County All Veterans Memorial Committee invites the public to visit the memorial site. It's located between the post office and the courthouse. New bricks to honor local veterans have been added. The Brainerd Honor Guard will play taps today at 11 a.m.
I guess it isn't appropriate to say Happy Veterans Day.
No.
But thank you for those of you who are veterans, who have served. We are grateful, those of us who did not have to serve.
Coming up at 9 o'clock, we have a couple of specials going on instead of Headwaters today. WHYY brings us the Conversations with Veterans, and then Paul Ingalls, Veterans Appreciation Music. That's at 10 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, DJ Ironsides is our host for On the River. Tonight at 7, John Henningsgaard.
Support comes from the Friends of Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge near McGregor, offering 18,000 acres of woods, water, and wildlife for the public to experience, located 5 miles south of McGregor on Highway 65. Learn more about Friends of Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge events and activities on Facebook.
It's going to be mostly cloudy today, highs 39 to 45 across the region with breezy southwest winds 10 to 20. Mostly cloudy overnight tonight, becoming mostly clear with a chance of rain and flurries in northeastern Minnesota. Lows in the upper 20s and breezy northwest winds 10 to 25. By Wednesday, sunny with highs in the low to mid 40s.
Wow, that'll feel pretty warm after the weekend we just had.
It was chilly and a little bit of snow and
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah, we had some snow that was... Well, it was, for me, the first snow of greater than a quarter inch and the first snow that remained on the ground for over 24 hours. So a couple of noteworthy events there. Typically, that happens around October 5th on average. So we skirted it by more than a month. And... I didn't mind. I've got most of my chores done, most of my fall chores done. A few things I've got to take care of yet, but I'll get to them.
I keep telling myself I don't mind. I didn't mind when it was happening, but I forget how gray November can be.
Yeah.
I'd actually like to have a little more on the ground. It feels brighter out when there's some snow on the ground.
Yeah, know? That's true. This is definitely... a great time of year, but I've been using this time to sort of enjoy the colors of different grasses. So all summer long, and we'll talk a little bit more about this on the Phenology Show, but all summer, you know, everything's kind of green and you sort of just let it sort of meld. And this time of year now, you look at a swamp or a wetlands, and you'll see a kind of a one color of grass goes right up to the edge of where the water table changes. And then you get a whole different color. Or if you're looking at a field that has some topography, some rising and falling field contours, you'll see at the bottoms of those contours one color of grass, and going up the hillside of the contour, a different color of grass. It's about moisture, and it's about sunlight, and it's about where they want to grow. And this time of year, that comes pretty apparent. The other thing I like about this time of year is that you can see the ground. You can see the topography. And where I live, I'm on sand dunes. I know, it sounds kind of crazy, but yeah, I'm on sand dunes. They're 10 to 12 feet high, and they sort of roll and undulate across the terrain. And it was at one point, part of Glacial Lake Upham. I'm on the northwest shore of what was Glacial Lake Upham. And when the river blew out down there by Aiken and the lakes drained, Glacial Lake Aiken and Glacial Lake Upham drained, it left behind huge lake bottoms. When you drive to Duluth, you're driving across a huge lake bottom. And that lake bottom, you know, no vegetation, the winds came along, picked up that sand and started to roll it into big hills. And that's what I have. I have big sand dunes. You wouldn't recognize them because they're covered with foliage and, you know, there's a foot of soil on top. I'm trying to think. Mineral soil below. And above that is this foot of humus and decaying leaf structure, so more like the growing kind of soil. But it's still, once you get down below that 1 foot layer, all you're looking at is sand for 18 to 20 feet. So it's interesting, and it's visible right now. So if you're, you know, driving around, or if you're just walking around your place, look at the topography and think about how it might have come to be. That's always something that I enjoy.
Mm-hmm. We have been watching down by the shoreline a snipe.
Oh.
Yeah, would that be a Wilson snipe?
That would be our snipe. Common snipe or Wilson snipe. I think Wilson snipe is the accepted name. What's it doing?
It's got that long bill and it's just poking down in the sand, just almost like a woodpecker might on a tree, but
yeah,
the opposite direction.
And you don't think it's a woodcock?
I don't think so.
Yeah, would, you would know.
Yeah.
I mean, their woodcock are kind of small and bulky, sort of fat little. I mean, it's not fair to call them fat. They're just short. they're compact.
Right.
And they have also a long beak, but I wouldn't expect them to be in a sandy area. They're going to be looking for worms, and that's going to move them up to the richer, deeper soils.
We were looking it up, and it looks like they're looking for, it said invertebrates.
Yeah.
What they're looking for.
Yeah.
So,
invertebrates. Yeah. Those things without a backbone.
It looks like it has a job to do. It's very busy.
Oh.
Very working hard down there, the snipe.
It's getting itself fed so that it can travel south.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a bunch of birds that are going to be traveling south. I've seen my last fox sparrow. Well, I think I've seen my last fox sparrow and American tree sparrow. The juncos are declining in numbers. So the birds that are kind of moving through are moving through. There will be a pack of birds coming in that will, you know, come to northern Minnesota as you know, as a nice balmy spot to spend the winter. So it'll be fun. It always is. And we'll talk a little bit about a lot of that on the Phenology Show coming up in an hour, maybe 40 minutes. Don't forget, the student phenology is coming up in another 10 minutes or so. And the interesting thing for me about student phenology is that it's a statewide sort of a view of what's happening in phenology. So you're going to hear reports from Virginia, from Grand Rapids. You're going to hear reports from Little Falls. You'll probably hear a report from Northfield. They're just, you know, there's a blanket laid over the state, and not everything that happens right where you are is happening where someone else is. And those people in Northfield are going to have a different view of fall than we have, just because they're 2.5 weeks south of us, if you want to go by time. Yeah, it doesn't take 2.5 weeks to get there, although I did have a car like that once. It's two and a half weeks of time.
The Fred Flintstone car?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
It would have been far more dependable if it had had a hole in the floor and I could have put my feet down and run. Yeah. Oh, well.
Coming up from National Native News, Dan Karpinchuk has the story on the celebration of Indigenous Veterans Day in Canada. Stay tuned for that story. And like John said, we've got phenology reports, nature reports coming up from students. Our question of the week, a lot of people already weighing in yesterday. We unveiled it. And this has to do with our What's for Breakfast guest last Friday that got a lot of people talking.
Oh.
We had Kevin on with us talking about when he moved to Grand Rapids and that in his home ec class, they made a gun case.
Oh, sewing.
Yes.
Oh,
and
okay.
He had never, and then they also, he'd lived in the Twin Cities, so he was not around gun culture. So he was very surprised by that. But that's what we want to know. Do you remember your home ec and your shop classes? We want to hear about some of those projects. Kathleen from Brainerd had said that the curriculum included baked goods and advanced cooking, lobster, and balanced nutritious meals and sewing. We made dresses, jumpers, and clothing repair. And she said she remembers the economic science part of the class, budgeting for food and all that kind of stuff.
My mother was a graduate of the University of Minnesota home ec.
Oh.
But she never taught it, or she but certainly she practiced.
Yes.
She lived it, indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
As far as shop class, I think I was just thinking about that. And the one thing that I learned in shop class was the importance of a sharp tool. Like, make your plane iron sharp. Make your saw sharp. And I remember trying to learn to cut with a handsaw and how difficult it was. But now I won't say I'm accomplished, but I can cut a straight line with a handsaw. And I'm grateful for the learning that I got. And as far as sharpening, my plane irons are all, well, not all, but many. Those of my favorite planes have good sharp edges on them. And I've learned how to strike a nice, even plane the edge of a board so that it matches the edge of another board.
Uh-huh.
Two flat surfaces coming together. It's an art. It's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah. I remember shop class, the leather, our family story was, I worked really, really hard, like made some keychains and stuff like that. But then we made a belt.
Mm.
I was not naturally gifted in leather work.
In belt making?
No. But man, I was happy to give that to my dad. I made him this belt.
Yeah.
And sadly, it had my grade on the back of it, which was a B-. But my dad probably wore that B- belt for 30 years. That's what he called it.
This B- belt.
Yep.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was better than average.
Yes.
Because if it lasted 30 years, that he did well.
Mm-hmm.
And your father must have been a pretty steady size.
He was, yes, during that time, I would say.
I've gone up a pant size or two since I was in high school, but if I'd made a belt in high school, I think I could still get it around me. I was about a 30-inch waist when I graduated, and I'm about a 34 now, so.
In case anyone's getting John pants, now you know. I also remember.
Don't.
We learned.
Do not. My wife is constantly, not constantly, my wife buys me clothing, and I'm the sort of guy who says, I got a closet full of perfectly good clothes that I haven't worn out yet. When I wear them out, I will accept new clothing. But it's like, good gosh, I don't care about new colors. I don't care about new designs. I care about, have I worn it out yet? Is it used up yet? And if it's not used up, I don't want to replace it. I'm comfortable with it. I'm going to keep it, so.
I also remember the wood shop with Mr. Johnson, and the big fear was like the girls, you had to put your hair back.
Oh,
because once a girl got it stuck in the lathe. And
oh, my.
That was the scary story. And
oof.
I feel like he repeated it every day. We were all pretty scared by that. And I was not good at metal class either, but tried my hardest and went after school to try to solder, and was not great at it. Made a really, really crappy napkin holder. But, you know.
I don't recall any metal work in shop. I remember the leather work, working with plastic. And
We had drafting, too, in the
drafting, yep. I remember that, too, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd never took a home ec class, and that probably was to my detriment. But
Yeah, I did not like the sewing part of home ec. I liked the cooking. I remember we made pumpernickel bread, and it had like a dark chocolate in it.
Ooh.
But it, you know, that doesn't have sugar.
Right.
And but we didn't completely melt it, so it's like there's a hunk of chocolate. It's not good.
Oh, this
not
bite's really good.
Yeah. You don't think of it that way. But anyway, we want to hear your stories. You can text us 218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Tuesday, Canadians will pause for Remembrance Day to honor those in the military who died serving their country, as well as those still serving. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, special ceremonies over the weekend honored Indigenous members of Canada's military.
It's Indigenous Veterans Day and has been commemorated since 1994. Indigenous members of Canada's military shared their stories at ceremonies across the country. In Ottawa, Defense Minister David McGuinty had this message for them.
Throughout our history, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis members have served with exceptional bravery and distinction in the Canadian Armed Forces. They have fought, endured, and sacrificed in our name. From Vimy to Dieppe, from Korea to Afghanistan, Indigenous service members have demonstrated extraordinary skill, courage, and devotion to duty.
Indigenous Veterans Day came about because many of those veterans were not given the same benefits as their non-Indigenous peers. Ray Deer is the president of Quebec's only First Nations-operated Canadian Legion. He says people need to know about the contributions made by Indigenous members of the military.
I think by joining the military, it gives us a voice. It gives us a voice that can be heard amongst the Canadians and the Americans because they know we served alongside them. Without doing that, without serving alongside them, you're more than invisible. We're invisible as it is, but we'd be worse off if we didn't participate.
Other Indigenous veterans say they gained respect from military colleagues for their character and their ability as soldiers. But some say the camaraderie vanished when the fighting was over and there was a return to Canada. The federal government says more than 4,000 Indigenous people served in the military in the First World War and 3,000 served in the Second World War. Recently, the government acknowledged the unfair treatment of Indigenous soldiers, where many thought their rights and standing would improve when they returned home. But as efforts towards reconciliation gained momentum in recent years, there was more effort to recognize Indigenous veterans and their contributions. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A tribal school district in northeast Wisconsin says the government shutdown has impacted federal funding it relies on for salaries, supplies, and student programming. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
The Menominee Indian School District is one of about 20 school districts in Wisconsin that receive impact aid funding. The program provides support for public schools on federal lands. Superintendent Marcus Denny says their district has limited access to local tax dollars due to a small taxable land base, so program funds cover about 40% of their budget, but payments haven't gone out because of the government shutdown.
So that's impacted our budget big time. We've had to move around a lot of funds from our general fund. We had to seek a line of credit with our bank to help meet operational needs. It's impacted us heavily.
The district serves about 1,000 students, and Denny says many of them come from high poverty backgrounds. He says food assistance cuts due to the government shutdown are also having a broader community impact, as many students don't have adequate access to food at home. Denny notes community organizations and the tribal government are working together to support local families by stocking food pantries and soliciting donations to send home with students. Denny says the Impact Aid Office has been in frequent communication with districts throughout the government shutdown and has informed them that payments will be processed once operations resume, despite concerns about resources becoming increasingly scarce should the shutdown continue. Denny says he has confidence in his community.
The Menominee people and Indigenous people in general are very resilient, and we've faced challenges for years with the government, and this is just another bump in the road for us, and we just continue to do what's best for our kids and our community.
I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part from the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the listeners of stations like KAXC. Thanks for being with us today. It is 6:49, looking like a kind of typical November day. Could we say that?
Mostly I would cloudy. Say.
Highs 39 to 45, pretty breezy. Southwest winds up to 20 and mostly cloudy overnight, becoming mostly clear. Some nice stars to gaze at.
Morning. There was a gorgeous moon and stars. Lovely night.
Always something to look at, even if it's a little bit gray out there. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. We've got student phonology coming up next. And later this morning, Pam Perry will be talking birds and frogs. And we'd love for you to weigh in. You can text us at 218-326-1234. Today at 1 o'clock, Northern Lights Community School in Warba invites the public to a Veterans Day program. Vietnam veteran Dennis Jerome, DJ the DJ, will speak about his experiences.
Support for KEXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. It is time for our student phenologies. Phenology Talkbacks. Our funding for Phenology Talkbacks are provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology Talkbacks are produced by our own Charlie Mitchell. And our first report comes from Lindsay Engel's class at North Star Elementary School in Virginia.
This is Charles,
Eli,
Maddie,
Anaya,
Gino,
Reese,
and Aiden.
With a report from North Star Elementary on November 6, 2025. We saw the first snow of the season on October 22nd.
Yesterday morning on November 5th, Mr. Galloway saw a blue heron flying over Gilbert. On Reese's camera at his house, he caught a bear going through his garbage on November 28th in Virginia. Hopefully that bear is heading to bed soon.
On Monday, November 3rd, Aiden saw a pair of swans hanging out on Silver Lake in Virginia.
Evelyn noticed a grouse run into the woods when she was on her way to school this morning.
There were three wolves in Lillian's yard last Saturday, November 1st. They were pretty interesting in her chickens, but fortunately the chickens were locked safely.
Other animal sightings include turkeys, a fox, and lots of deer. We're probably seeing more deer due to the shorter daylight hours. Deer are most active at dawn and dusk, and now we are too. This pattern of activity is called crepuscular. Wolves, moose, and bobcats, coyotes, and raccoons are crepuscular. This is a great time of year to see wildlife since we don't have to stay up too late to see them.
On the night of November 5th, many of us enjoyed the view of a supermoon. A supermoon is a full moon that occurs at its closest point in its elliptical orbit. Some of us were lucky enough to see northern lights dancing overhead at around 8:15 on the same night.
This has been a report from North Star Elementary in Virginia.
Keep exploring the great outdoors!
Wow, thanks Charles, Aiden, Eli, Reese, Anaya, Gino, and Maddie. Great report. Lots of interesting things. Lots of good sightings there. A great blue heron on November 5th. That's not completely out of the ordinary. It's a bit unusual, but blue herons will stay until the very last possible moment, and then they'll get up and leave. Many have already left, but there are always some that will stay until they find ice forming around their legs. The interesting thing about the blue herons is that they all come back, or they return mostly as a group right around the 1st of April. It's pretty close to the 1st of April, 4 or 5 days on either side of that date, regardless. So they are an interesting bird to watch. Swans, grouse, some chickens that were stalked by some wolves at Lillian's. That's pretty interesting. Turkeys, fox, lots of deer. Nice little note about crepuscular activity. Maybe that's a word you weren't familiar with. I'm so glad that the kids in Lindsay's class are learning about such things. And then the supermoon, which was absolutely stunning on November 5th, and following that, the northern lights that danced around in the skies. It was quite a night that night. I'm glad that they got a chance to check it out. Our next report comes from Mrs. Pagel's class at Cohasset Elementary. All right.
Hi, this is Eloise, Bear, Carter, Nelson, Hudson, and Christella, reporting from Cohasset Elementary School in Cohasset, Minnesota, with our phenology report from October 23rd. On October 23rd, we noticed the temperature was 35 degrees Fahrenheit and the wind was blowing from the north. In Hibbing, it was snowing mixed with about 45% rain. On our walk today, we learned about different trees and some different plants.
We observed the large maple trees across the street from our school on the west side of the building has only about 45% of its leaves left. The leaves are all colored. There's a big cottonwood tree north of the maple tree. Most of its leaves are still green, about 85%, and only a few, like 15%, have turned yellow. The cottonwood tree is not native to this area, so the leaves will not change color.
We learned that all pine trees are evergreens, but not all evergreens are pine trees. Mr. Latimer pointed out a red pine tree and explained that the branches and pine cones are like a timeline. Pine cones grow for 2 years. You can tell a spruce tree and a balsam tree apart by looking at their needles. Both trees have needles that grow one at a time on the branches. But spruce needles are square and you can roll them between your fingers. Balsam needles are flat like paper and you can't roll them.
As we walked around our school, we discovered there are dandelions that have gone to seed and some that still have their flowers. We found out dandelions originally came from Europe. Dandelions are really tough plants and can grow almost anywhere. The roots, leaves, and flowers of the plant are all edible. We also learned that the ends of the seeds have a barb and a parachute. The barbs hold the seeds onto the plant.
The parachute helps the seeds spread out as they float to the ground to plant new dandelions. When a dandelion turns to a seed or looks white and fluffy, you can blow the seeds off, but they only fly out the side you blow on. Mr. Latimer taught us about red clover. It is still blooming on the grass. Red clover petals can taste a little sugary if you try them, and that's why bugs drink the nectar.
In the swamp on the east side of the school, we spotted that asters have gone to seed. The bottom of the flower is brown and looks like a star. Aster is a Greek word that means star. Dark plants are growing in the swamp. They are easy to spot now because their flowers are brown like coffee or chocolate. This has been Christella, Hudson, Nelson, Carter, Bear, and Eloise reporting from Cohasset Elementary.
Thank you, kids. That was a great report. Lots of good information in there. You can tell that they've been listening to Mr. Latimer. We did observe the maple tree and from 2 weeks ago, last week, looking at it with a different classroom, we saw that the leaves had all fallen off of the maple. The cottonwoods were about half down and moving that way, and we're kind of watching cottonwoods as we get into fall. Also noticed the needle factor on the balsams and the white spruce, and we checked out the needles on the Norway pines as well, so they had a really good view there, and they were very attentive to our work on dandelions, all of the uses for the dandelions, and the way that the seeds actually come off the flower head, and how they, when they do come off the flower head, how they land and how they catch the soil and dig themselves in. And the kids did get a chance. We found some asters. We plucked the fluffy seeds off of them and looked at the bracts underneath and showed them the star-like shape of them and talked about how that gave the aster its name. We will continue with our morning phenology, our student phenology, in the next hour at about 7:45. We'll continue with more reports from students from across the state. In the meantime, I need to tell you that you are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org.
Looking at the weather conditions across the region, clear skies in Brainerd 27, 23 in Hibbing, Fair, and Grand Rapids at 26. Bemidji Fair, 25 degrees, 28 in Aiken right now, and 24 in Park Rapids. Looks like Embarrass reporting 25 and McGregor at